Hey, y'all. Pretend we're football for the next hour. I'm your host, Will Baser, and I'm joined alongside by Timothy Preston and Johnny Brashear. You guys are listening to the Hornscast channel, which you guys can find on any podcasting platform out there. Today, we're going to be talking about the past two games where Texas barely escaped McNeese State and UAB, and the next game coming up against, you guys know it, Texas A&M. What do we expect out of the Aggies, and how are the Longhorns going to attack them? Fellas, how are we doing? How are we doing this week?
But before we start, I think we need to make a change to our podcasting format, or maybe add a rule after McNeese State, and I don't even know how many others. We need to stop saying Texas should beat this team comfortably. Because I don't know how many of it's going to take before we learn our lesson. It's like a given that any team we say, yeah, no, they should beat this team comfortably. Like Oklahoma State last year in Stillwater.
Or Georgetown this year.
Or, you know, it's just, we got to stop saying that. Even if they're bad teams.
I want to go
back
and listen to the Radford preview.
Yeah, nobody wants to do that. So I am not going to say that from here on out. Please, if you catch me saying it, let me know so I can slap myself. But I'm not saying, yeah, we should beat that team very comfortably. Just from here on out.
The fact that we don't beat them comfortably does not change the fact that we should beat them comfortably. So I think you should keep doing you, my guy.
We should, but we won't.
Yep.
That's Texas basketball for you fellas. That's just basketball this year. Like every team that you should beat by a lot, it just doesn't happen.
Well, I don't ever like bringing the lead out this early, but I guess I've been thinking about this a lot. The last 3 years, really the entirety of our podcast run, which is, well, it's just really depressing. But
4 years,
it's depressing. I mean, if think about it, we started at the 11-22 season, so we've been on an upward trajectory the entire time.
Well, upward and then downward and then hopefully upward again, but
sort of a false flat.
So like, so many of just like a lot of time and equity put into Johnny and I trying. I mean, pretty, I don't know about convincingly, but certainly, you know, like we're in earnest to say that, hey, Will, we are better than our record shows. We, like, if you look at these specific metrics, we're not as bad as our record shows. It's kind of refreshing and fun to be like, ooh, we might not be as good as our record is, but that's nice to do. Okay, I like being 7-1, even if we're really not maybe a 7-1 team at this point. That's kind of cool. So, of all the things we could be, 7-1 is pretty good. It's pretty good.
Is that Texas's best start since we've been doing this show?
Yes, they were 6-2 from their first eight the year that Andrew got diagnosed. And the two losses were to Gonzaga and Duke in overtime. So a little bit different than this year as far as who we played and what we were doing, but yes. So 6-2. His first year that had Isaiah Taylor, they were 5-3, I believe, and then last year they were 5-3.
So this is the best Texas has done in a while, but still, that McNeese State game was a little too close for comfort, y'all. It was down to the wire to the very, very end in a team that Texas was favored to beat by 23 points by Vegas. I mean, honestly, at this point, you're going to make money betting against Texas when they go up against a team where they're favored by above 20 points. Just go ahead and bet on the other team. Just Texas can't do it. Texas cannot put away these teams that, like Tim said, they should. Is there any reason, y'all, that we should be worried, Longhorn fans should be worried, after an abysmal showing against McNeese State this past week?
I mean, not more than normal.
You like, should always, if you're a Texas basketball fan, you should just be inherently worried.
I mean, you know, if anything, if we've learned anything in the past decade of Texas basketball, it's that they're going to fuck something up at some point. Like, what you're hoping for is that they don't pull a Radford, they don't lose to Chaminade. Like, you're hoping that they avoid those sort of things, because everything else is pretty recoverable. You know, if they win one or two of the games that were within five in the conference that they lost, they're in the NCAA tournament, right? Like, that's not a big jump in recoverability. But you can't really win a game against McNeese State. Like, I mean, yes, it's a W in the win column, but if you beat them by a lot, you were supposed to beat them by a lot. If you beat them by very little, everybody's like, oh God, Texas is back to its bullshit. And they're not, it's not without merit, right? Like, they had some problems. But I don't know that, I guess what I would take from it that I would be more worried about than I might have otherwise been is that the defense was not good for yet another game. Like, it was not as bad as Georgetown, but it was not good.
I guess my big thing about the McNeese State game is if there are people out there who are expecting us to be who are trying to equate us winning games with us being terrific, they probably just haven't been paying attention. So I'm just going to assume they're not podcast listeners in the first place. So because of that, I guess I come away from the McNeese State game feeling pretty good. As ridiculous as that sounds, McNeese State, like Georgetown did, exposed some deficiencies that we continue having in the ball screen defense. They also showed what it's going to be like for us when teams hit tough. Like, if we're trying to force teams to hit tough two-point shots and then teams do that, we're going to have a hard time answering sometimes, because sometimes those tough two-point shots can lead to some offensive rebounds for them too, although we rebounded pretty well against them. But can we rebound as well against McNeese as well as we did against McNeese against some of the better teams? So plenty of question marks. But, man, last year we talked about it a lot. Like, this team found ways to lose. Like, they found ways to lose. And against McNeese State, we hit some big shots, and we came through and got a clutch stop at the end, and Ramey hit a couple of free throws at the end. And, you know, after an entire game of playing miserably against Radford, we still couldn't hit big shots at the end. After an entire game of playing poorly against VCU last year, we couldn't get it done at the end. After a game of playing not great against McNeese State, we pulled it out. You know, so there's some things from the game that obviously you're like, well, shit, if some teams can extrapolate that against us, then we're going to struggle. But I refuse to succumb to some negativity about McNeese State. That's a heck of a program that got down there in. Louisiana. And.
Can't even get the city.
And I think that we should all feel pretty good about it.
Yeah. Okay. So he's not going to engage in the negativity. I will.
This is just the rules of the podcast.
I'm going to put in a Shyamalan twist and be like, it's not that bad. So other than Andrew Jones sagging way off a dude who only shoots threes, which he did repeatedly, like the reason McNeese State made it as close as they did, well, there's two things offensively. One is that they fed down low and were good on the low post. Two, Andrew Jones repeatedly let Drew Cuxhausen get loose. Like, he was sagging way too far off him. And he does this every game, regardless of the situation. Like, when we get into the UAB thing, we could talk about how he was on the complete wrong side of the court at one point because he felt like he was going to get into things. ?
It sounds like he was sagging. If he was guarding Jace Febres, he was sagging 5 feet off of him.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, I mean, that's basically it. Like, Cuxhausen, that's his thing. He shoots threes, and Ramey guarded him closely. Coleman guarded him closely, limited his effectiveness. Andrew Jones got on him, and he hit three threes in the second half. And that's part of why the game was as close as it was. It's not just that. Like, there are legitimate concerns about post play and how a strong low post presence can cause Texas problems. not that I'm thinking about Kansas and scream crying, but the that's something that's going to have to be figured out. The pick and roll defense is still a problem because either they don't reliably fight their screens well enough, or the big hedge is hard and nobody's back covering the roller. You know, it's things like that they got to work on. But those are tweaks to the defense that are manageable, as opposed to like last year where they let teams shoot 40% from three, which is just sort of, I don't know what you're going to do about that. So, you know, it's fair to be somewhat concerned about McNeese State in that the defense was a problem again. And if you have Shaka and Yaklich on this coaching staff, the defense should not really be a problem that often. But at the same time, it is still relatively early in the season. They're still getting some kinks worked out. And hopefully these sorts of problems will not manifest themselves as often, like in conference play, for example.
So how would you go about, either one of y'all, taking care of the pick and roll issues? What is the main issue that Texas keeps on facing in that area? Is it really the personnel? Is it the coaching that's going on? Is it the schemes that they're being put into? What is the main issue there?
Well, for me, I think with the pick and roll, the issue is more about the big not recovering quickly enough. One of the posters on Barking Carnival mentioned, it might have been Jeff Haley, actually, who talked about how you can have the big sort of drop back into almost like a zone where they're basically splitting the difference between the roller and the ball handler to sort of discourage, like not flat out deny the pass to the roller, but discourage it. And I think a guy like Sims could do that really well with his length and his athleticism. That might be a better idea than doing the hard hedge where, like, if you're going to hard hedge and get into a trap, you need to get up on the guy. And it seems like Sims does this somewhat well, but none of the other bigs do this well at all, where they get on the hard hedge and they just sort of stay in the general vicinity of the ball handler. They don't get up on him and actually block passing lanes. And so there are things that are open that should not be if it was executed properly. So I think either getting them to get up on that hedge and get close, or to fall back and sort of play that kind of zone where they're dropping back and sort of discouraging the pass to the roller. Those would be things I would work on.
Yeah, you're not wrong, Johnny. I like it. The thing that I guess I'll go the opposite way and say that I can't really tell what the impetus is for our guards or wings when they're guarding, when they are being screened. So, like, okay, so let's get the outlier out of the way. Matt is playing defense at a remarkable level. Remarkable. And he is reading ball screens super early and plays on top of ball screens and gets through. And, like, there's been a couple of times where particularly Jericho, like, is, like, hedging and thinking he's there, but Matt actually beats everyone to the spot and is there. And Jericho's like, wait, I'm supposed to head. What do I? And it has to recover, like, with Matt already in position, which is cool. And Matt's doing that. But everyone who is not Matt, Courtney's been better, but everyone who is not Matt, like, are we switching? Are we playing under? Are we trying to go over the top? Are we playing through? Are we being physical with the ball screen? Are we allowing the hard hedge from the big man? Like, it just, there just seems to not be a true central theme to what we're doing. And so I understand Jericho, like having some of that hesitance, because it just seems like, depending on who it is that, you know, whose man it is that's being screened, they're playing it in different ways. And Courtney has a knack to play under, and Andrew seems to want to play over, but maybe doesn't have the quickness just yet. And Jace has not looked great defensively at this point so far in the seat. Like, it seems like, depending on who they screen, Gerald has kind of looked slow defensively too. So there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that. I don't want to say that it's, you know, the fault of all those guys, because I can't really fault Jace for not being the quickest guy on the court, but it does seem like if there is a set answer to how we're going to deal with those ball screens, I think we need to get more consistency from our guards and wings as far as like, okay, maybe Matt does this, the rest of us do this every single time. And I don't see that consistency just yet. So whether that's Luke kind of putting those pieces into play over a period of time, I guess I hope slash want that to be the case. Or if that's truly like the guys like, you know, if you beat him to here, you do this. If you don't beat him here, you do this. And so if that's a struggle, I'm not really sure. But I agree that Johnny's right. The big men are struggling. But I think that might be because our smaller players are just so inconsistent with how they're playing it.
I kind of wonder, and I'll pose this as a question to you, Tim, is if you think, and this is sort of unknowable since neither of us are in the coaching room, how much of this you think might be a byproduct of them being very specific with their scouting reports, where they say, okay, well, with this guy we switch, with this guy we don't switch, with this guy we, you know, we run over the ball screen, with this guy we run under, and maybe it's like a bit too much information and they might need to simplify a little bit and just be like, okay, we're switching 1 through 4 other than Matt or whatever,
right?
And say, we'll do that, and once you guys get that down, we'll start adding in the wrinkles.
Yeah, and I think maybe what happened, I don't know. I don't know. And it's a tough question to ask. But I wonder if they have simplified since the first game. Because it's felt like maybe they had hoped that they wouldn't have to play through and just like maybe would allow Matt to do that. But now it just again, it's so erratic that it either has to be what you're talking about, where they had hoped that there would be some of that athleticism piece there where they could say, all right, well, everyone's going to fight through. And like, oh, okay, no, not everyone can fight through. And so now they're adjusting on the fly, which is tough to do mid-season. But I would not be surprised if there was one expectation going into it, and then here we are, what, 4 weeks in, and they've had to shift and change some about who can do what and when and how that's going to impact that initial ball screen action from us.
No, I mean, that's fair. Like I don't really know one way or the other, just because I'm not, again, we're not in the room with them to say what they're teaching them to do or what they're trying to do in an individual game. Like if, I guess what I'm sort of doing is putting the pieces together, knowing that Jaklic is a very details-oriented guy, and he watches a, you know, he eats tape, as the football guys would say.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, he's very specific with his scouting. So I could see him, you know, like he came from Michigan where he had a couple of extremely good perimeter defenders that he was able to get very nuanced with. And maybe he tried to get that nuanced with these guys a bit too early and say, hey, well, you know, if you're against this guy, you go over the screen. If you're with this guy, you know, you switch. And maybe that's sort of why it just seems a little helter-skelter.
Well, the next game went a lot better for the Longhorns, beating UAB and holding them, even though they had a lot of surges. Texas is only really favored in this game by 14 points, so 10-point win, still pretty good. And especially with Andrew Jones going off, what are the pauses we can take away after that McNeese State with UAB? Tim, you're the positive guy. Let's start with you.
Yeah. Well, if there's
nothing, everything is terrible.
I need to have like except for Jace, and then except for that, you know, 90-second
press
span.
Press defense?
Yeah.
Except for the rebounding.
Well, yeah. UAB, now, let's give UAB a little bit of credit. That's a team that's going to rebound pretty well all year long. I thought Jace's shot selection was not great. I thought Courtney had that weird 90-second span where, like, Kai got that block. We went down, and Courtney pulls up from, like, 26 feet and bricks it. And then UAB goes the other way, and Courtney steals the ball and goes down and pulls up and bricks it. And then, you know, it was a timeout shortly after that, and you could see Raimi just like, God damn it, what am I doing? With the exception of that, I thought UAB was actually an example of us utilizing terrific shot selection. just terrific. And it was, for me, it was Andrew Jones's best shot selection maybe ever at Texas, even against Northern Colorado when he looked good. Like, there's some of those Northern Colorado shots where it's like, okay, dude, like, that's fine. But I thought he shot in rhythm. I thought Courtney shot in rhythm. I thought Matt looked good. I thought Jericho kind of, like, did a good job of forcing the issue where, like, he was able to kind of shoot down at the rim a few times where we needed him to like, kind of get us a basket. So if McNeese State was a question of us, of them catching us at a time where we just, I don't want to say weren't ready to play, but just like weren't firing on all cylinders, weren't ready to kind of get things going. UAB was an example of, no, we're better than this team. We're going to out execute them. We're going to get some stops when we need them, and maybe they'll hit some good shots, but we're going to outclass them. Which is what you want us to do. Like, if we had beaten Radford by 10 last year, everyone would have been like, yeah, that's legit. Would have liked for more, but that's a good win. I think this is one of those wins where you say, okay, this is a team that, even if we're not perfect, we're getting a win that looks pretty good against a team that's not bad.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to, as much as we need to keep an eye on the rebounding issues because as the season goes on, because there are going to be rebounding issues as the season goes on, unless there's a
just big men issues in general.
Well, I mean, not just big men, right? I mean, yes, them. Like, I think Sims is fine in terms of rebounding. It's everyone else that is sort of going to have to pick it up.
The 3-4 freshmen behind him.
Well, them or Liddell or Jones or Donovan Williams or whoever's playing sort of that wings position, so to speak, all of them are going to have to pick it up for Texas to rebound at a good rate defensively. Offensively, I don't think they're ever going to do it just because that's not really the design. They sort of just schematically get back on defense rather than go for offensive rebounds a ton. So that number is never going to be great. With that said, UAB is a very good rebounding team, so I'm not too worried about the rebounding numbers from this game. There are other teams that I will be more concerned about it than I am with this one. Like, if you look at UAB on the season, they are, I think they're top, yeah, they're ninth nationally in offensive rebounding percentage. So that's something they do very well, and they're top third in the country in terms of limiting offensive rebounds from other teams. So that part does not, it doesn't concern me in and of itself. Now, if it manifests itself as a pattern, that's a big deal. I think what I am, more than anything, if I'm going to take a positive out of this, it's that the good Courtney Ramey showed up, and he showed up for a full game. Now he did have that span that Tim mentioned, but there was another point where, it's sort of the up and down nature of Ramey is that he went up, he shot a questionable three, and then there was another, there was an exchange of possessions, and on the next possession down, there was a transition opportunity, and instead of pulling up for another questionable three, he skipped past it over to, I think it was Coleman, who nailed the three. And, it's like stuff like that where you see him. He could have gotten frustrated. He could have gotten his head out of the game, and he didn't. So that was nice. It was obviously good to see Andrew Jones shooting really well. I agree with Tim's overall point that the shot selection from all the guards was better across the board. There were a lot less off the dribble threes than there were in the prior game. It was a lot more spot up threes, which is what you want to see them take. Whether they hit a ton of them or not, it is just it's a better shot for them to take if they got their feet set. So,
I mean, one of the things that I've noticed this year is the ball movement on offense has just gotten 10 times better. The ability for them to, it maybe happens a few times a game, but it's still happening where they are moving the ball back and forth throughout the defense, and then at some point they finally break down the defense and it opens up a three. And I believe that was one of Andrew Jones's threes in this game, where love to see him go off, where they just broke down the defense and he hit the three. It was beautiful.
Yeah, it's a fine line, right, where there is moving the ball around the perimeter to initiate the offense, and then there's moving the ball around the perimeter, which doesn't warp the defense at all, right? And you obviously want more of the former than the latter, and it happens when you move it around the perimeter and then follow it with paint touches or, you know, penetration to try and get into the paint. That's sort of where you kind of move things around. Just sort of doing the handoff, you know, where you pass it to Sims and he hands it back to the guy, like, that doesn't really warp things unless you do something off of it.
I love that action though, man. I love that.
It has a lot of potential, right? Yeah. But you've got to do something with it, because otherwise you just have two defenders right next to two offensive guys and right. Nothing's happened, right? So
sure.
I don't have a problem with the action. It just needs to be followed with something.
Yeah, but it's a fun wrinkle.
I'm thinking of like Jackie Moon passing back and forth.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
no, that's semi-pro.
Yeah, there we go. Just do that for 25 seconds for the the shot clock.
Back to me. No. Back to me. No.
That's a good summary of the Texas Tech offense against DePaul last night. By the way, this is 25 seconds of no. We're gonna do something. We're gonna do something eventually.
Which DePaul, one of 16 unbeaten teams left in the nation.
Yep. Yep,
and DePaul actually played like shit. I don't know if people watched that game or not. They did not play well for like the first 35 minutes of that game. Like they just kind of scrummed around and got things going eventually. But they did. It's not like Texas Tech was like taking blows from DePaul. It's just like they actually kind of got DePaul's C or B game and still couldn't play.
Yeah. Yeah. Tech was not. It wasn't Tech's phenomenal defense really doing it. their defense is fine, but it's not nearly what it was last year. Anyway, back to the Texas game. Sorry. It's good to see them bounce back from a near win with a solid win, or a close win with a solid win, near loss, or as I would probably put it, with a solid win. It's good to see them kind of play a generally better defensive effort. The energy was there, even if the execution wasn't always there. And they just, you know, generally speaking, it was a better effort from the team.
Yeah. Before we move on to Texas A&M, I do want to say, to Johnny's initial point about rebounding, if Jace and Andrew and Royce continue to rebound as ineffectively as they have, we're gonna have problems. We simply must get better defensive numbers or defensive rebounding numbers out of Andrew and Jace in particular. I mean, Royce is playing, what, like 8 minutes a game, so like it's hard to...
Liddell needs to rebound more.
Oh, see, I don't think so, man. His numbers as far as per minute are good. Like they're way good. I don't disagree with you. I think he needs to rebound better, but I don't know if I would say way better. He's actually been pretty solid, but like Jace has something like 18 rebounds in 260 minutes or some crazy thing like that. And Andrew might even be worse. Compare that to Ramey, who's, you know, I think Ramey's our second or third leading rebounder. But Liddell, as much as we all agree he can do more, I think he's our second leading rebounder at this point, or him or Ramey, and it's very close between the two of them. So how that, but just the fact that we're talking about that is another example of like, oh shit, what are we going to do? Like, who is our second rebounder? Because it's either Sims and then a guard, or Sims and Liddell, who everyone thinks needs to pick his game up kind of everywhere. So but as positive as Matt and Courtney have been on the glass, that's how disappointing to me Andrew and Jace have been.
Yeah. So can we talk about Kai Jones?
Yeah.
This is a perfect, Tim's going to make a drink while Johnny expresses some things he's going through.
So, I liked Kai Jones's fervor.
He has a lot of fervor. He has a lot of energy. He has a lot of desire. Really brings his lunch pail to work, you know what I'm saying?
He brought energy to that team, man.
He brought energy.
You can't hate Kai Jones.
Look, and here's... So, okay.
I can and I will.
It was interesting reading everyone else's opinion of Kai Jones in the UAB game. And I felt like such an outlier that I Like, this is, I called Tim to be like, am I losing my mind?
True story. Like, true story.
I did. I called him because everyone else is like, he was a defensive, you know, he was awesome.
No, he wasn't.
I expect even
I could see that. He got turned on so easily.
No. Yeah. He didn't get turned on. He got himself like 8 feet out of position. And then they turned on him because there was nothing else to do.
Like, I expect Lance Blanks to say dumb shit on TV, right? Like, and I hate to say it because, like, I grew up on the BMW guys, right? So I don't want to say that Lance Blanks sounds like
an idiot. I do and I will. Because, I do want to say dumb shit and I will.
He's such a homer. And, like, there was the point where Kai took a three and Lance Blanks said, with a straight face, that was warranted. I'm like, no, it was not warranted. God, no, stop it. Anyway, okay, so Kai Jones,
he's probably better than the guy who is on the radio with Craig Way.
What, Eddie Orin?
I'll
have to go back and listen to that because Eddie Orin is, he's a hoot.
that's one way to put it.
Ask Luke Daxtel, am I right?
He was with Penders, and then I think I looked it up, and I think he's still a scout with the Brooklyn Nets,
really?
Which is sort of amazing. anyway, so
Penders looks rough, by the way, rough. Well,
yeah, he's been soaked in alcohol for 30 years.
Oh, so. Is that my future? Oh no.
That's why you work out, Tim, so you don't turn into Penders.
5Ks. Let's fucking go.
So, okay, Kai Jones, his on-ball defense is okay. Like, if he was not pterodactyl long, he would be a terrible defender because his length allows him to make up for his fuck-ups against a team like UAB. It won't against a team like Kansas. Or, you know, some of the other teams, like Baylor probably will roast him because he is so incredibly raw. He is such a lump of clay that he's like, his off-ball defense was, I imagine it would have been better if you'd given him bath salts before the game, maybe.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Because he was so far out of position. It's like he was the basketball defensive equivalent of the dude who plays the Street Fighter champion and beats him by mashing buttons because he's so far out of the realm of what that guy's expecting in the Street Fighter that he's like, I don't know how to combat this. This is insane. he would be so far out of position that UAB'd be like, is he going for what is he doing? Is he going for a bathroom break? And it would fuck up their offense. Like, he had some really good plays, but like two of his three blocks, he had to block that shot because he got beat so badly by the guy. He had to recover and block that shot, or else it would have probably, he might have gotten benched, honestly, if he hadn't blocked those shots. So I like Kai's long-term potential. I'm not trying to be a hater, but he is terrible defensively. And the people who are talking about him starting, please don't do that to my liver. I can't handle that. That's too much.
Johnny, you are inherently a hater. That's just kind of, you were born into this life a hater.
Okay, I wasn't intentionally being a hater. How's that?
There you go. All
right. I'm gonna offer a brief counterpoint and really brief with an anecdote.
Oh, fuck you, man! I called you about this.
In 2009, Jordan Hamilton, who was a freshman at that point, got into Rick's doghouse because Jordan Hamilton knew how. That sounds really nasty. Well, I would just say it. He knew how gifted he was. He knew how talented he was, and so when he wasn't getting big minutes, it felt like when he went into a game, he's like, I want to make a difference, I want to change things, and so Jordan Hamilton did what Jordan Hamilton does, which is chuck. All right, I'm just going to fucking chuck, and we'll see what happens. I'm going to do my best. Because he didn't know how to impact the game any other way, right? That was who he was in high school and in AAU, and so when he played for Texas, which is why he was fucking brought there in the first place, not to be a defender, but to do his best and be an offensive impact player. And so
it was like Jace Febres on steroids.
Right. Oh my gosh. And just way better. Just much, much better than Jace. But I, where I will applaud Kai is that, I think he's a guy that actually, that is willing to say, I want to make an impact however I can. And sometimes you see really good players when they are forced to kind of like when they've been struggling to get minutes or when they're not put in the game in the way that they would like to be, they don't quite understand how to, like, what can I do? How can I do this? And Kai seems to be hell-bent to say, okay, I'm going to give fucking everything I have. I'm going to play as hard as I possibly can. And so he's going to get himself out of position sometimes, as Johnny said, because it's just not
sometimes.
Many times. Almost always. But at the very least, like, he comes back and he fights hard to get those. And the fact that you're talking about a guy with the athletic baseline that he does, when you see him start to play even kind of fundamentally sound defense, holy poop, like he's got a chance to be really, really good. And you hate to just like, we're 7-1. Why would I poo-poo this season? Man, Will, if this team stays around and they add Brown, like it's been a number of times, but you see Kai Jones is like, where his ceiling could be, you see how well Matt is playing. If Courtney can like keep a little bit of this momentum going, like Johnny's right. Lump of clay, not close to where it's going to be, but he also got those blocks. He also didn't get truly burned all that often because of that athleticism and that explosiveness. And gosh, next
Tim,
year, Will.
I'm gonna stop you right here.
No, why? No, I'm just
because
getting going.
I stopped listening after you said holy poo and poo poo. Because that's funny.
So someone asked me to describe Kai Jones, and I inadvertently came up with what I feel like is the perfect description of Kai Jones, is that someone put Javon Carter into one of those avatar machines about 5 minutes before tip-off and let him loose on the court. And that's basically what Kai Jones is Javon Carter trying to figure out how to use his limbs because he's not used to being 6'10 or whatever. And so he's just sort of rumbling around the court, like going for steals that he thinks he should get, but he's like way too long and he's way past the play and he's just way out of position. And if he can figure out how to be a 6'10 Javon Carter, he's going to be this malevolent force on the court. And I hope he does, because that would be fucking awesome. But right now it's like sort of like watching a newborn deer try to run around everywhere. It's just kind of crazy to watch.
It is, but that 11 foot pull up floater off the bounce was incredible. It was incredible.
Y'all, I mean, I know y'all love talking about Kai Jones, but I really want to talk about poo because Tim brought it up. So, what is y'all's favorite memory about playing A&M in basketball?
Ooh.
No.
Jesus Christ. Ooh. Incredible.
That was a dirty transition.
Incredible.
Could,
favorite memory about playing A&M. I think it's still got to be just like the total dominance that we had over them when we first started the Big 12, where like Rick Barnes was something like 26-1 or whatever in his first 27 games against all Texas opponents in the Big 12. That was a very special time for me. And another reason of why, like, people who point to Rick's early success and like, well, what about Shaka? He's trash. Think about Rick's first. Like, again, like, Baylor and A&M and Tech were just bad at that point. But I guess the other one would be my very, very favorite A&M memory was the 08 game. I think that's right. Yeah, it was, like, February of 08. So Durant was gone, and so the team was DJ Augustine and AJ Abrams and Damian James, and we had lost at A&M by 20 or so, and I want to say Texas got up like 24-4 in that game that was in Austin, and it just like was just like the crowd was going ape shit, and Abrams hit like two or three crazy threes, and Augustine had been in a slump, and he came out and. and they had some. Anyways, it was that was a blast. That game was really fun, and that was one of those games like, oh, okay, this team's got some moxie. We're gonna be pretty good.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to go with the year before, which was the double overtime game,
the AC Law game,
AC Law and Kevin Durant game.
Yeah,
you know, there's while the Texas A&M football series was not particularly close most of the time, outside of like a run in the 90s and maybe late 80s, for the most part, it was Texas won like 70% of those games, so it's not really a rivalry in the truth like it is with Oklahoma, for example. The basketball one felt like it got pretty even for a while, which was kind of fun. And that was during the Barnes and the Gillespie years and, you know, those kind of that general range where you had Durant and AC Law who were just, I mean, as two assassins going at it. And it was a phenomenal game. Whether Texas won or lost that game, that was going to be an awesome game to talk about because it was just, you know, it was just so fun watching those guys duel it out. And I mean, there were other guys who did really well in those games, but you know, Durant and AC Law were clearly the highlights of those two games or of that game. And watching Texas win that game in double overtime was really cool.
So now we got to go to what's coming up next, which is A&M. What can we expect out of this Texas A&M team? You know, it might be a little different than what we faced against AC Law, but I do want to know what we're expecting out of this Texas A&M team that just lost to Fairfield and Harvard.
Yeah, it did. Texas should clearly win this game. Wait, I'm sorry. Hang on.
Comfortably.
I don't know what it was.
Texas is going to win this game comfortably.
It's just no other option.
Oh, that's
go
it.
Ahead
they're,
and turn the podcast
gonna,
off now.
They're going to fucking lose this game now. Texas A&M is terrible offensively. They don't do anything well except maybe free throws. Like they draw free throws. They don't make free throws at a good rate. They're worse than Texas at 3-point percentage and 2-point percentage. In fact, there's only like seven teams in D1 who shoot the three ball worse than A&M does, which is a problem because A&M is in the top like 20% nationally in percentage of their field goals being 3-point attempts. So they're making like 24%.
In terms of they live and die on the three, they die on the three.
Yeah, mostly. Yes, mostly. you know, it's year one of Buzz Williams, who I think is a very good coach. I would be happy to have him at Texas. I think he will eventually turn this thing around. The issue for him is trying to cobble this season together in something that doesn't like pull the rug out from under him early. Sort of like they're at the point now where it's not out of the realm of possibility that he has a like Shaka 11-22 type season this year. That's on the table because they got beat by Gonzaga by 30. They lost to Harvard. They lost to Temple. They lost to Fairfield. They've lost four of their last five and their last three in a row. And the SEC is a good ass league this year. So, there's a good chance that Texas A&M is in for an extremely rough season. And, you know, I kind of hope that they have a really terrible season because that means Buzz might be available sooner than later if this Shaka thing doesn't work out. but that notwithstanding, you know, they're a solid defensive team. They're actually a pretty good defensive team. So that's, if anything that will keep them in this game, it's that. But offensively, they're just, like, if you look at Pomeroy's stats, the greener a stat is, the better it is. The redder a stat is, the worse it is, generally speaking. And their offensive side is just red up and down. Like, there's not much green in there at all. Like, they're just not good offensively this year.
I watched the Gonzaga game, and it was
a murder?
It was funny how bad it was. Like, just funny, you know? And when the game got done, you know, Buzz, like, didn't seem angry. He didn't seem, like, perturbed by what it seemed like. He, like, jovially walked over and, like, kind of, like, gave Mark Few a hug and, like, a high five and stuff. Like, hey, I bet you guys are hungry after beating us mercilessly. Or whatever. Like, there's a decent restaurant here in town.
Hey, Freebird started there, so...
That just, it was a offensively, you just, when you watch them play, like, I'm not kidding you, they looked like, there were times where we looked in the last few years as like bad, but they looked clueless. Like, they had no idea what they were doing. And I actually kind of like Savion Flagg. I think he's a pretty decent player. He's a guy I wouldn't have minded us getting, but other than him, I just don't know who hurts us. And kiss of death, right? Like, now they're going to come out and play hard. And maybe they will play really hard. Maybe it's going to be a game where Buzz has them just absolutely, like, gangbusters to play Texas. And what a rivalry and what a tradition and whatever. Like, maybe. But they're just not good. And I don't mean, like, they've got some bad losses. I mean, like, no, when you watch them play, they're just not very good. So, you know, if we're not ready to play, or if we get a stinker from all of Courtney and Jace and Andrew, I mean, sure, could we lose to them? Absolutely, we could lose to them. No question about that. But anything
can happen in a rivalry.
Yeah, but I don't think they're very good. Like a few years ago when we played them, the year that we went 11-22, I think that we played them in
was the Bahamas?
I think so. And yeah. And like we weren't very good.
Oh yeah, I was there for that. Yeah, yeah, I was at Atlantis for that.
Yeah,
that
was, and they beat us by like 10 or 12, you. Right? Like yeah. We hung tough in there, and we did our best, but they beat us relatively soundly, and that's what I think will happen. I wouldn't be surprised if A&M plays really hard, and Williams, as Johnny said, Williams is like an objectively good coach. He's quite good. But I don't think his team is very good right now, and I think that he knows it. So they're going to have to really, really have a heck of a game, and we'll have to probably play not well at all. And even then, I think we'll have a pretty okay shot.
Plus, it's in Fort Worth at Dickey's Arena, which is this brand new arena that it has a capacity of like 13,300, I think I saw. And if you go on Ticketmaster, there are a pretty significant number of tickets for sale. but most of the
you so know, it'll feel like a home game.
Well, yeah, it's
yeah.
Like I
a de facto
thought,
home game, my friend.
Well, I thought in like in the preseason, I kind of thought this would be like a, you know, be like 2/3 full, and it'll probably be mostly Aggies because they'll be re-energized by a new coach, and you know, et cetera, et cetera. And now that this is that the wheels are falling off for them, kind of feel like it's going to be one of those like third full, you know, maybe a pretty even split. Like all of the courtside seats I saw for sale that were resale were selling for below face value, and it's, you know, 3 days out, so you might be able to get a good deal in a courtside seat if you want one if you're not watching NFL football like the rest of America on a Sunday afternoon. So yeah, it's I don't think it's going to be an imposing environment.
It looks like a cool venue, though. So that's cool.
So how is Texas going to try to attack A&M in this game? What is that going to look like? What's going to be the main focus for the Longhorns?
I don't think things change a lot. I think that you know, this team has a pretty clear offensive set. We're going to get a lot of that high ball screen, and then off of that high ball screen, you've got some options. Are we going to get the dribble handoff? Are we going to start doing some of the handoff replacement stuff? Do we get a game where I actually thought against UAB, I enjoyed seeing Courtney as that high ball screen ball handler most of the time. Matt was actually, I think it was something when I saw some of the numbers, Matt was the high ball screen less than 25% of the time, which seems way low. But he just, you know, he went to the corner, and then they had him as kind of the safety valve and a straight line driver off of some of the read and react stuff that we did, which was cool. So I don't think A&M poses enough of a threat, offensively that we're going to have to get outside of our comfort zone. What I really want to see that Johnny alluded to earlier in this game or early in the podcast is that we look so much more comfortable and so much more in rhythm when we can get shots off of dribble penetration, which we've talked about many times in the past, but that was so obvious. And to go from the McNeese State game, where there were a lot of pull-up threes, a lot of deep threes, a lot of, like, skips and reversal threes where we just, like, you know, kind of shot it when we weren't shot ready, and we're getting some kind of weird passes into those. To compare that to immediately after with the UAB game where I think we shot, what, like 44% from three, and a lot of that was Andrew shooting 6 for 8. But I'd like to see us have some of that discipline, know that we're going to have some options as far as, like, I don't think even if A&M plays a great game that they can run away from us. So if we can stay inside of our looks, be multiple in some of those ball screen looks that we have, and then make good shot or have good shot selection, I think that that it could be a game where I don't think we'll be shocked at some weird wrinkle that Shaka throws in there offensively.
Yeah, Kai Jones at the point is what I'm expecting.
Yeah. Jericho and Kai setting ball screens for each other just over and over.
Yeah, it's going to be the Jericho 3-point festival is what it is. Like, he's already hitting free throws, so we're just going to him do that trebuchet shot from the 3-point
line.
When
Kai Jones took that 3 against UAB, I don't know if I facepalmed harder since when Jericho Sims tried to shoot a 3.
Oh, God, I want him
to
do one this year.
What about the 3 when Royce took earlier this year? At least Royce. You could kind of understand Kai. Like, Kai's form looked at least okay. Jericho's was just like a newborn baby shooting a 3. And Royce looked like, oh, they've been telling the whole team, if we're open, we can shoot it. So I'm going to shoot it now. I shouldn't have done that. I should not have done that.
I can't get over the fact that when Will Baker shoots 3s, he looks like the dude from Nintendo Double Dribble.
He gets so small. How do you pack that 7-foot frame into like a 5-foot-1 body for that second
It's amazing.
Trapped?
Like, look, I'm sure those things are going to fall eventually, and then I'm just going to make double dribble jokes constantly once he starts making them. Right now, I just feel bad, so I'm not going to make those jokes.
So my last question about the A&M game is, what are the chances these two teams are going to give the fans what they actually want to see, which is, of course,
blowjobs?
A fight?
Oh, I think it's incredibly unlikely. I mean, look, in general, basketball players don't fight. Like, that's just not really, this is not football. This is not, you know, rugby. They don't fight.
I want a Malice in the Palace level fight here.
Yeah, but that's sort of the point, right? Is that Malice in the Palace happened, what, 15 years ago? Like, that's your point of reference. So, I don't think this is going to be the one to do it, you know?
One Malice in the Palace every 15 years is fine with me.
Okay, now, is there any Texas player that you could see fighting anyone? I mean, Ramey,
Jericho,
I guess.
Sims. I mean, you see the fire in his eyes every time he goes up to do literally anything?
There is no one less... Okay, was that... Oh, was that a joke?
That's yes, a good thing, yeah, Tim?
That's a good one. Okay, that's a good one. I like it. I thought you were serious, like your dipshit brother, but...
Courtney... Courtney Ramey. Courtney Ramey.
Yeah, Ramey would fight someone.
Ramey,
yes,
Ramey will stab a dude. Like, I'm convinced of it. Like,
Drayton Whiteside.
What's that?
Drayton Whiteside storming the court.
Ramey has had a shank, like, in his socks this entire season, and he's just been waiting. Like,
I just that SNL sketch with, like, the digital short with Ray Lewis. Like, after he stabs it, oh, shit. I can see Ramey doing it. Sorry. Yeah, I just interrupted. Sorry. Oh, boy.
No, it's fine. We all watch SNL digital shorts these days. It's...
Ace and Gary. Well, it was like 12 years ago, something like that. That's fun. Sorry. I'm sorry, guys.
Okay, so pretend you're getting to know us, guys. Yeah.
It's
now
time.
The perfect time.
Yep. What a segue. All right.
You what's your favorite SNL digital short and why?
No. That'll be next week. This week is, what is the dumbest idea you have ever had that actually worked? Tim?
Okay.
No, we'll let you let Tim go last. Johnny?
Yeah, you got to let him be the cleanup hitter.
Yeah.
So when I was in high school, One of the summer jobs I had was, so Dad's been in real estate for a very, very long time. In fact, I'm pretty sure I saw a thing from a day planner the day I was born that had like my date written down on it, or the time written down on it, which makes me think maybe Dad was working when I was born. That's, I'm not 100% on that. I really need to find out the logistics from him at some point. Like, were you working when I was born? Because it's... It seems very on brand for you, but I'm just gonna ask. So, anyway, he has been doing commercial real estate for quite a while, and he gave myself and a friend of mine a job putting up signs on like land that they had for sale that he was brokering, and these would be like 3-foot by 5-foot signs that are pretty substantial, and you had to put in posts, dig holes for posts and set them up and do the whole thing. But you also had to take them down, right? So there was that. And we were supposed to take this one series of posts down because there was we had to put a different sign up and the posts were in terrible condition. And we could not get this one post out of the ground. And now, mind you, I, a tennis player, and my buddy, a track guy, we're not exactly the most, intimidating presences that you would find. Like, he did hurdles, so it was not. Neither of us were like exactly cavemen coming out to knock things out. So we tried to get this thing out, and it just wasn't coming out. And so he had a 1976 Ford Bronco that he did not give a shit about, which is like, it was like 2 tons of steel, basically. And we did a number of dumb things in that thing. But one of them in particular was that we had him drive up onto the land and then just sort of give that post a couple nudges with the front bumper.
I saw that coming from a mile away.
Yeah, no, it was like, We just had him, actually, I think he might have let me do it, where it was like, no, just go ahead and ram it a little bit. It'd be like, thunk, thunk. Like, nope, hadn't quite done it. All right, back up, thunk. There we go. We got it. Yeah. So we eventually got it out of the ground by hitting it with a SUV a few times. It was not the smartest idea we ever had, but it worked.
Hey, it worked.
It worked a lot better than the time I hit him in the dick with a pickaxe. So that's
oh, I remember that. That's same, yeah. Same dude.
Yeah, same
oh,
guy.
Oh boy,
same guy.
Whew.
Yeah,
whew, man.
Got real.
That's that was a few times. That was a few pretend you're getting notices ago.
Yep,
that was also a tongue twister. But I'll go now. So mine, I can use the excuse of I was drunk, unlike you, Johnny, and your friend.
Yeah, I wasn't drunk. We were just. High school guys.
Yeah. I was in high school and I was drunk and I didn't want my parents to figure out. We had these dog doors.
Oh, and, no.
And to avoid setting off the alarm, so that my parents wouldn't wake up, I crawled through 2 sets of dog doors. That I was very much bigger, but I figured a way to shimmy my way through 2 sets of dog doors to get into the house undetected.
I'm just imagining, like, not. I mean, I appreciate you were trying to avoid the alarms, but I'm just imagining your parents, like, upstairs in their wasp-ass house, like, being woken up by the sounds of drunken Will just sort of slamming the door against the frame over and over again, like, oh, I got a shoulder through. Like, I feel like they probably just didn't bring it up. They're like, he's home safe, it's fine.
No,
it's
just, my parents were pretty oblivious to what was going on downstairs when it came to drinking, so I figured that out when my sister got away with it quite often.
And she went through the dog doors too?
No, that was my brother.
Oh, all right.
That was my brother and his friends, except for the inside dog. We had two dog doors because they went through the garage. And for him and his friends, the inside dog door was locked. So they slept in the garage.
That's some rich ass shit to have two dog doors.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, well, you know, they had their own wing of the house and we didn't really want them getting in this wing. So we set up a third dog door just to keep them in this wing.
The stretch, Johnny.
Yeah, it was.
Tim?
All right. So I think I have two, actually, if that's okay. This might be, is this a first?
No, it's not.
I think this is a first. This is a first. Okay. So the first one is when I was in college, and this was like either the end of my freshman year or my sophomore year. At least, I think end of my freshman year, there was a 7-Up campaign, like a commercial advertisement campaign, where Orlando Jones had a t-shirt that said, "Make 7-Up yours," right? But the front of his shirt said, "Make 7," and then the back of his shirt said, "Up yours."
Oh, so I remember those.
Yeah, so the commercials were just kind of ridiculous. He's walking, he's like, "Hey, guys, make 7-Up yours," and people are like, "Hey, fuck you," like in the commercials or whatever. So I had a great idea. In college, it was actually just a terrible idea, to make my own shirt. And so I had a shirt that I was going to say was...
Wait, like from scratch?
Yes. Yep. It was gray. It was a gray shirt cut off, as is tradition. And it said... I made it myself with some paint. And I said on the front, "Make 7." And then on the back, I didn't say "Up yours." I said, "Fuck you." So my shirt said, "Make 7, fuck you." And first off, I just want to say this initially. Somehow, the shirt came out incredibly. Like, it did not look like I puff painted it. It looked like it was, like
puff paint.
Professional quality. I will say that clearly and easily. Professional quality. And then, second of all, like, is that a really funny joke? I mean, it's fine. Oh, the people in Iowa ate it up. They ate it up. They adored it. And here's how I can tell you. This is one of my proudest achievements. So I have a friend from college who now is a professor back at where I went to school. And I gave my shirt that I made to a younger friend of mine who, like, you know, we befriended, who was, I think, like a freshman when I was a junior. And I gave him the shirt, and he started wearing it around. And so my friend, who is a professor there now, was at one of the bars there on like a Saturday evening, but not like late. But he was there, and he saw it. He saw the shirt. This was like 2017. He's like, "That was your shirt that you made." I was like, "I know what? Let's go." He saw the shirt like 16 years later. Someone was wearing it around. It was the exact same shirt I made. Looked a little bit worse for the wear, as is tradition, but he made it. Now, that being said, I have another one that I thought was incredible. Okay, so we're in central Iowa, right? It's middle of winter, and I am...
Do I not get to react to... the fact that people ate up being told "fuck you."
Yeah, make 7 fuck you. Right, it was incredible.
Yeah,
you
no, I just I what I really enjoy is the idea of people who may not have seen the front of the shirt and just saw a guy walking around saying "fuck you" to everybody
in a cutoff, and right?
And being from the Midwest, they're like, "Hey, all right, he's pretty cool."
Sounds like something you'd see at a Walmart.
I like that guy. Right. I like him. Yeah. Okay, so this other time was
but all in like the American flag colors. Yeah.
Or one of those shirts where it just says like it just has the random descriptors where it's like, "I'm an American who has a beard, who sometimes likes to take walks on the beaches, and fuck you."
So those are all good things, but you're cutting into my mojo for my next story. Okay, so I was, again, I think I was either 18 or 19, and so I went to high school in a town called Story City, and the nearest, well, one of the nearer towns was a town called Jewell, Iowa. It's about 20 minutes north of Ames. They were one of our big rivals, South Hamilton. Get out of here, you bastards. So we were partying in South Hamilton because, you know, the sluts. And so we're partying up there, and I had a lot to drink, way more than I should have. And so I was like, "I'm going to puke." So
Were you right now or more?
Oh, wait. Oh, come on, Will. Come on. Look, I could... Come on. Okay. So we were partying up there in Jewell, and we're driving home, and it's like a number of my friends, probably like 5 or 6 at least of my friends are with me in the car. Like, "Guys, pull over. We're on the interstate." I'm like, "Pull over. Like, we're on the interstate. Like, pull over." So we pull over, and then I kind of like go into the ditch and I yak all over the place. And they're like, okay, we got to go. We're on the interstate. Like, no, just leave me. Just leave me, guys. Like, no, it's like winter. We're not going to leave you in the snow. Like, you don't even have a coat on. Just leave me. So they keep on driving me home. And we get home. And, like, my parents are both pastors. So, like, when I, you know, like both, I'm a double PK. So mom and dad are pastors. Right. So not a surprise that I'm a heavy drinker. All right. So we get home. And I just assume it's like, you know, it's like 2:30 in the morning. So I just assume that they're not going to be up. They're both awake. And they're sitting in the living room waiting for me. And I'm just smashed. And I just yacked everywhere. So I'm sure I smelled terrible. So all of my friends, like our house, like that particular house was really big. So they, my friends all went upstairs. And like I stumble into the house. And my friends like, oh, shit. Tim's parents are awake. And so they all hurried up into my bedroom. And they were just like playing Nintendo or some shit. And I like you gotta talk to him. So I was like, all right. So I talked to my parents, and I'm sure they're like, why are you smashed? Like, what's going on? And like, this is a bad life choice. Like, yeah, it's fine or whatever, right? So then I talked to him about stuff for probably, they said like 25 minutes, and then like I'm sure my parents were like, okay, go upstairs, dipshit. So I went upstairs, and I was like, I did it. And all of my friends were like, yeah! They just like, go nuts. So I'm sure my parents were downstairs like, what the fuck? And, you know, and my friends were just going ape shit because they were so excited that I talked my parents out of getting me in trouble, even though I was out of high school, so I probably should have been out of the house in the first place. But it was great.
I kind of want to hear a pastor say dipshit.
And I also don't know that...
He swore in front of you.
Did he? Yeah, but it's like it feels like it would mean more if I knew he was a pastor at the time.
That story didn't seem like it really fit the entire question either.
Yeah, it didn't. No.
It was a really. Bad choice that went incredibly well.
I don't think it went incredibly well. I think your parents just let you deal. Like, they were like, he's too drunk. It's not worth fighting this.
Don't ruin this for me, guys. Later. Don't ruin this for me. That was it.
Tim, it was a terrible idea that went perfectly well, Tim. You know, you were completely right.
Thanks, man.
But on that note, y'all, thank you for pretending we were football for the past hour. I've been your host, Will Baizer. You guys can find me on Twitter at WILLBAIZER. Mr. Johnny Brashear, where can we find you?
I am on Twitter at BitterWhiteGuy, also on Barking Carnival.
And Johnny, where in the world is Mr. Timothy Preston?
Well,
baby,
Tim is actually spending the weekend training for a Himalayan climb. But since he lives in Iowa, where the overpasses are the biggest hills, he has to simulate the hills by putting a treadmill up on his roof. And so he's spent the weekend putting a treadmill up there where he's got to sort of prop it up so that he can also not just be on the treadmill and on the roof, but the treadmill can actually go up to like 20%. Close to me, like my mother, close to me, like my father,
close to me, like my sister, close to me, like my brother. And you are the only one, you're my everything. And for you, the song I sing. Take it, Will. Baby. No Casey and JoJo from you? All my life?
I thought that was R. Kelly, honestly.
No, it's not R. Kelly. It's Casey and JoJo.
Tim, we're all disappointed. Tim, but where can we find you besides, you know, Casey JoJo concerts?
Oh, great. I wish. You can't find tickets to that. Good grief. InsideTexas.com. Awesome basketball community. Come hang out with us. And on Twitter, InsideTexasHoop, no S.
And Tim, where can we find you on the basketball court?
With my bad back, almost nowhere lately. But really, for the most part, I'm most comfortable on the perimeter.
He's the guy wearing the fuck you jersey.
Yeah, make 7 fuck you. Yep.
But number seven, fuck you.
As comfortable as I am from the perimeter, I guess where I find the most comfort is inside with the big boys. But if you want to know where I'm really, really most comfortable, it's right in your fucking face.
You guys can find us and our other shows on the Hornets Cast Channel. It's the Hornets Cast Channel on any podcasting platform out there, like Podbean, Spotify, Google Play, iTunes, anywhere. And on that note, thank y'all for joining us, and we'll see y'all next week. Hook 'em.
Hook 'em.